Okay, so what I do today is based on that today is celebrated as Christmas by the Christians and others, I thought it was important that we have a clear understanding of the flaws of other religions, but specifically we're going to just deal with Christianity and what the faults are. It'll be broken up into four sections. We're going to first discuss the essential flaws in Christianity's tenets. Then we're going to talk about the primitive nature and also the mass appeal of Christianity, why it spreads so quickly. Then we're going to show examples of how Christianity denies God's own words. And we'll conclude with showing how it's a corrupt philosophy and actually plagiarizes the Torah. So again, what the goal here is both for Jew and for Gentile alike. It's not going to be a bashing type of discussion. I know that a lot of times this is the approach that people take. I think it's incorrect. The individual is not the concern in terms of showing a philosophy as being false. What we're concerned with is the philosophy itself. And those who try to attack people, individuals, is really wrong, and it creates discord. And it doesn't really produce anything positive in terms of knowledge. And knowledge and reason is really what the tools that we have that God gave us, and no other being, in order to discern what's the right path for us to live. Okay. So I just want to make that clear. In terms of the first section, in terms of the essential flaws in Christianity's tenets. So the basic distinction in terms of Christianity as compared to Judaism is that there's no proof in Christianity of their tenets. Judaism, conversely, is based on an event which was witnessed by approximately 2.5 million people. And the event at Sinai is what we're referring to, and it's recorded in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 9 through 15. Now, it's essential that you become fully aware of the historically proven event on Mount Sinai where God demonstrated his existence and selection of the Jews to adhere to his Torah. The event was witnessed, again, like I said, like 2.5 million people, and it's a proof not duplicated in any other culture or religion. Now, it's impossible that the basis of the proof that the event actually took place, that it's basically impossible that history contains the account at Sinai where Jews heard an intelligent voice emanating from the fiery mountain. They saw no physical source, and we see the story was accepted up to the present day. It's accepted by the world over, or predominantly. And had Sinai never occurred, it would not be accepted back then, and it wouldn't survive throughout time. For example, if people would posit and say that really the story didn't take place, and Moses really lied, I mean, there had to be somebody who was promulgating a story, because we do have a story today. So for those who want the proponents of the view that Sinai didn't take place, which are few, and have no support, they're baseless. So let's say, for example, if Moses lied and he attempted to convince people back then that they saw all these miracles, that they saw a mountain completely on fire, and they heard a voice, but they saw no form, and that if Moses would also want to try to prove to them that there were 2.5 million people there that they saw, they would look at Moses as a fraud, because they would say, well, I wasn't there. But the fact that we have the story today is a testament to the truth of the story. There's no way to have a story of this magnitude and of the events that took place to be transmitted throughout all the generations, and that you would have identical accounts throughout the world. So the very fact that we have the story today, and the story itself describes the number of people at the event, gives us the proof. Whereas in Christianity, there is no such event, and no other religion has this, not just Christianity. Now, in addition to that, it's not only the concept that the event took place, that God actually did this one-time event, But God's very words in the Torah, which even the Christians hold on to, the Old Testament as they call it, but God's very words attest to the fact that Judaism will be the one eternal and exclusive religion. It says in Deuteronomy chapter 4 and its verses 33 and 34, and I quote, "Has any people heard the voice of God speaking from amidst fire, as you have heard and lived? Or has God miraculously come to select one nation from others with miracles, signs, and wonders, and with war, and the mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and with great awesome deeds, as all that Hashem your God did for you in Egypt in front of your eyes?" So here Moses is clearly recounting to the Jews what they saw at the event at Sinai. And this is part of the story which was accepted and transmitted. And again, the fact that we have the story in our possession today, the world over, it's impossible that this could have taken place, that this could not have taken place, and that we would have it. Additionally, there's no, for those who want to posit that God didn't, which again a few, there's no alternative history of the Jews. So they're forced to come up with some sort of a baseless excuse as to why or what actually took place during that time if Sinai really didn't take place. And they would again have to deny all the miracles of Egypt and the Exodus, things which actually Egyptian history has corroborated. So Moses here, he reminds the people of the Jews' selection by God. God selected the Jews from all of the nations, and it was never performed by any other nation. Christianity, on the other hand, does not accept God's selection of the Jewish nation because they ultimately feel that they are going to have the eternal kingdom. What they base themselves on, again, another essential element which shows the problems in Christianity, is they base, as all other religions do, they base their views, their religion, on the words of one person. And that's a very safe, you know, very safe position. Because if a person comes along today and says that God appeared to me and told me, you know, this is now the new religion you've got to follow, so it's not something which you can disprove. But keep in mind, it's not something that you can prove either. Okay. So that's number one. In terms of the proof that we have as compared to all the religions that have no proof. And, you know, a religion is not something to be looked at as any different than a science in terms of its veracity. The same intelligence that we use to prove something is science is what a person has to use to prove any concept as being true or any event as being true. And this is what God actually did, is he wanted the Jewish system to be something which is not just for that era, but that it should be intact throughout all time. And that's why God created in the event that he created the whole event of Sinai, in order to be a clear proof for all generations. Another problem that Christianity contains is the claim that God became physical. The notion of God becoming physical is an impossibility, meaning that which created all existence is the one being that's not subject to the laws which he uses to govern all physical matter. To suggest that God can become physical and be subject to the physical laws means that God doesn't control the universe, which is a contradiction and an impossibility. So what we're saying here is that to say that God will become physical, as they say regarding Jesus, so they're positing that God now becomes governed by the very laws that he created. Okay. Now what we'll do is, as we finish the section, I'll give time for a question and answer period. Now there will be a number of points, so if you want to just jot down what the questions are, this way you'll be able to keep track of what you want to ask. A third concept, just in terms of the internal flaws in reason and in terms of their religion, is the concept that Jesus died for other people's sins. Now that's very appealing because it gives a person an out and no responsibility for his actions. But again, since we have proved that God actually gave the Torah and that event took place And the truth is that Christians also hold on to the Old Testament. So they have an internal contradiction based on what it says in Deuteronomy 24:16. And I quote, "There will not be killed fathers for sons," meaning the son's sins, "nor are sons killed for father's sins. Each man in his own sin will be killed." End quote. So God says clearly that each person dies or is punished for his own sins and not for somebody else's. So the verse teaches the theory that the death of Jesus on behalf of other people's sins is contrary to God's own words. Okay, there's really no way out. It's at least Deuteronomy 24:16. Right? It's a very important verse to know. I mean, as all the Torah is, but apropos to what we're discussing, specifically about the concept, the Christian concept that Jesus died for other people's sins, the Torah's words completely contradict that. Okay. A fourth concept that is problematic with Christianity is the blind faith aspect, which is an essential pillar of their whole belief system. Now, what's the problem with blind faith? The problem is that blind faith can be used for any idea or religion. Belief seeks no support from reality. So just because you believe in something, it doesn't validate it, it doesn't verify it. Christianity teaches what is not real. They're basically saying, believe in what you want. Of course, they want you to believe in their religion. But I guess they don't know this, is that contrary to their own Christian's goal, their whole, you know, Christian goals, they teach that defectors of Christianity find the other religions more emotionally appealing is actually proper, because they basically hold blind faith. Christianity's tenet of blind faith would require them to allow their Christian followers to follow any religion and deny Jesus if they followed faith, because they're saying that faith is really what the person should be functioning on. This is the modus operandi, the mode of operation that they demand of their followers, faith. So now the problem would come up for the Christians is if somebody says, well, I don't believe in Jesus, I have blind faith about something else. So how could Christianity argue? They're not based on reason. So a system of faith other than Christianity cannot be argued as wrong, because they're not basing their whole system on any arguments. It's an incoherent and completely contradictory position. If Christianity, however, attempts to lodge a reason to justify Christianity as the supreme religion, then they thereby deny their own principle of blind faith. Because now they're going to resort to reason, and that goes against their principle that you should be following Jesus and Christianity based on faith. So you see that there's an internal contradiction again in terms of their whole view of blind faith. Because if they're going to hold that blind faith is a praiseworthy character trait, a praiseworthy method of being religious, so then when another person wants to defect from Christianity and follow another religion based on blind faith, Christianity really has no argument. So they really shoot themselves in the foot with this. And again, it's unfortunate for the Christian adherents that will just follow what their leaders tell them. And we'll get into a bit of that too, like what the appeal is. But here we've just shown that blind faith has an eternal contradiction. And additionally, we'll get into the next idea now, which follows on the coattails of this one, which is that Christianity denies our use of God-given intelligence. So here there's a very big problem. I mean, in the most important of all areas, which is our belief in God's word, Christianity asks people to abandon reason. Sinai was orchestrated by God to achieve a proof of God's existence and a desired system for man. No other religion can make such a historically proven claim. And basically, God intended man to use his reason and to arrive at the correct life. Christianity, on the other hand, asks man to violate God's intent and abandon reason, just living by faith. So here we see that the concept of blind faith actually is contrary to God's will that man use his intelligence. Man is the one creature that God gave intelligence to. That means it's given to man for the purpose of utilization and engaging it for living his life, especially in the most important areas, and that is philosophy, man's concept of God, man's belief in God. Okay. A sixth concept that's problematic, and it's very brief but to the point, and somebody actually mentioned to me, which I'll convey it to you, is that not observing God's 10 Noahide laws is a sin against God. Meaning Christianity opposes God's will that all Gentiles follow the 7 Noahide laws that are outlined in the Torah. Christianity is the development of, actually fabrication of a system that God did not orchestrate himself by their not following the 7 Noahide laws is clearly a sin against God. A very basic point. And finally, in this first section that we're discussing regarding just the internal flaws, the whole concept of Christianity is they hide behind a, and I don't mean the people, I mean the ones who orchestrated the religion. Because again, we're not interested in condemning people. We're interested in exposing falsehood that leads people astray. And God's concern is not that just the Jew have a good life, but that all mankind have a good life. And that's why the Torah system is for all mankind. Yes, it's true that the Jews have many more commands. That does not mean that the non-Jew, the Gentile, is not desired by God to have life. The very fact that he exists shows that God desires that he has existence and lives properly, but in accordance with the one system that God gave. Now, this is I'm quoting from a rabbi that I once heard speak, and he made this point that Christianity is considered by themselves as a religion of love. And as he once noted, it's really an attempt to deny an underlying religion of hate. What do I mean it's a religion of hate? Jesus, in effect, murdered God. As Jesus existed, his whole existence replaced God's existence. So if you think about that, Jesus' existence is ipso facto the removal of God. So calling the religion one of love is an attempt to deny Christianity's true, hateful, and aggressive ideology, which is throughout history, crusades, Christianity's intolerance of other religions, and their creed of eternal damnation for those who deny Jesus. So you see in, you know, in different areas how this actual expression, this intolerance, the crusades, which were born out of the Christian belief, and this eternal damnation that if you don't follow us, that's it. The scare tactic is something which really exposes a hateful feeling. But in order to overcompensate for the real hatred, so Christianity has to hide behind this religion of love. So it's a fallacy. Okay, so the next point, the next section, which is Christianity's primitive nature and mass appeal. So let's just discuss that a bit. Okay, the first topic I just want to mention is deification of man, where man is deified. Christianity primarily affords mass appeal to its adherents through many false ideas. We already mentioned one that's basically the guilt-free existence because Jesus dies for one's sins. Accordingly, a man's sins can be absolved, and man has to take no responsibility for his corrupt actions, even though it's baseless and false. Another primary element in the Christian religion is the idea of the satisfaction of the emotional need for man's approval, meaning the man Jesus is a central focus. Okay, so what do I mean in terms of the approval of man? When man's younger, he develops an over-attachment to his parents, projecting on them a supreme authoritative status. We see this in children, and they seek the approval of the parents, and conversely, when they have the disappointment of the parents, it's the most devastating experience for a child. Now, some people never grow out of this emotion and find satisfaction, even in adult life, by idolizing human figures. So the need for the social approval is not something which man grows out of in many cases, unfortunately, and he seeks to constantly find satisfaction for it. And this is basically what the, you know, a main ailment in having a man being the center of Christianity is supposed to afford its adherents. And that is that he's looking down on me, he's taking care of me, there's an approval. It's the attachment to the person. Conversely, Judaism teaches that man is simply flesh and blood, with no powers. God remains the central focus of Judaism. And there's numerous laws that prohibit man from seeking other men's approval and projecting superhuman qualities onto man. In contrast, for example, to Christianity's saints, Judaism's prophets always shun the spotlight. And I'll give you an example from Elisha, who he himself didn't approach Naaman. Naaman was a general of the army of Aram. Naaman was smitten with leprosy. So he was told by his king, go to the Jewish people, they have prophets and they can heal you. So Naaman, being completely smitten with leprosy, went to the king of the Jews and said, I hear that you can heal me. So the king rent his clothes because he thought this is like a pretense for war, because he said, how am I going to heal you from leprosy? So Elisha, who was a prophet at the time, sent a message to the king saying, haven't you heard there's still prophets in Israel? But what happened? Elisha said, send Naaman here and we'll heal him of leprosy. But Elisha did not himself go out of his house to approach Naaman. What did he do? He sent a servant out with instructions to dip himself in the Jordan River 7 times, and this would cure Naaman's leprosy. The reason for this, and you see that, what was Naaman's response? Naaman said, oh, I thought you would come out and wave your hand over the place of my leprosy and I'd be healed, because Naaman himself was subject to the need of approval by man and looking at man as being the center, because he didn't have the correct philosophy, where Elisha, being a prophet of God, of Judaism, had the correct idea, but was careful not to ever try to take any credit, because he knew that he wasn't doing anything. He just told instructions to a servant. But where did Elisha get the idea that he should bathe in the Jordan 7 times? That was given to him by God. Elisha has no powers, he's flesh and blood. So we see that Elisha did not want another human being, even though he was from another country and not Jewish, he was still concerned that this general, Naaman, did not have any type of false ideas about man, meaning that man would have any powers. This is something which is not true, and Elisha did everything he could to avoid giving this impression. That's why Elisha didn't go out and do it, because then Naaman would think, oh, there's something special about Elisha. No, Elisha sent out a servant, told him to go ahead and dip himself in the Jordan 7 times. So Elisha wished that God alone maintains responsibility for the government of man and nature. And additionally, you see from the Jewish system that idolatry and warlocks, enchanters, and witches, just to name a few, are prohibited by Judaism. Each law is an example of Judaism's goal to extricate man from believing in any power outside of God. And we see our commentaries, the great sages Ibn Ezra and Maimonides, they state that all these practices are actually false, and this is why, like Ibn Ezra says, he says, this is why the Torah prohibits being involved in any type of this idolatrous practice, because it's false. But the reason why people are attracted to them is because now I can be attracted to man. Now I'm going to look to a man for the approval. And this is basically living in an infantile stage where you never grew out of your image of your parents as being superhuman and being able to take care of you. So this type of a need, hopefully a person when they mature, they realize their parents are no different than they are. And then they abandon that idea and realize man is all just flesh and blood, and really God is the only being that is responsible for the entire universe and the only being that should have the focus. And that is the whole goal of Judaism, is to give us an appreciation of God's wisdom and his abilities. Okay, so that's number one. All right. In terms of the primitive nature of Christianity. That's deification of man. Okay, that's a very important one. Another problem in terms of the primitive aspect, and also with the mass appeal, where is that generated from in Christianity? Why did it spread like wildfire throughout the world? This is the concept of the denial of the sexual drive, and that there are certain holy people and saints, and also this is also related to the virgin birth. All right, what we're trying to do is key in on major themes and major elements of the Christian ideology and trying to understand what its appeal is, and what exactly the flaws are from a completely intelligent, rational standpoint. And again, we're using God's, proven system of the Torah as what the correct guidelines should be. So let's talk a little bit about the denial of the sexual drive, the holy people, and the virgin birth. So this is basically a permutation of what we just discussed. Because Christianity places nuns and priests on pedestals. And just in terms of instant messages, I'll just ask if you can hold off on doing that. We'll have a question and answer session at the end of each one of the sessions we're discussing. So I'd appreciate if you could hold off on instant messages. Okay, so what does Christianity do? They place nuns and priests on pedestals. Part of their aura is the deprivation of sex. Christianity seeks to create saints by praising those who abstain from these areas in which man feels shame or guilt. Okay, so that's important. The concept of the deprivation of the sexual, and to say that a person is not involved in it, is something which they praise. But what's the right attitude towards this drive? How should man look at it? Judaism doesn't deny man's powerful urges. But what does Judaism do? It asks man to channel those urges to the proper partner, and only at the appropriate times, and under the right circumstances. I mean, there's certain times in the month that a person is allowed to be with their wife or husband, certain times not. There are certain people you can marry, certain people that you cannot. So it's not a free-for-all in terms of an outlet of the sexual urges and satisfaction of them, but it's also not a denial. This is part of our nature, and there's strong drives, and they're needed to be strong because you see that it's God's will that man should procreate and populate the world. Meaning to say that man is not asked by Judaism to deny his desires, but also he can't be steeped in his desires. There has to be a balance. And the reason why there's a balance is because there's a higher goal for men. This practice is basically to redirect man and his energies towards higher goals of pursuing wisdom and justice. Again, we see that man was given the intelligence by God for the purpose of using it over all, you know, other faculties that he had, that he possesses. It's true you have many, many emotions, but they're all there for a good, not to be abused. The reason why, and again, this is something I heard from a teacher of mine, a very nice idea, that Maimonides' whole principle, the golden mean, that if a person shouldn't be too miserly with his money, but he also shouldn't be a spendthrift. A person shouldn't be too introverted, not too extroverted. A person shouldn't be too giddy all the time, and he also shouldn't be morbid. But he should be in the middle. Now, why should he be in the middle? The golden mean, the shvil hazav, as Rambam, as Maimonides puts it, and explained by this rabbi, is that when you're in the middle, you're equidistant from the extremes that have the strongest polar magnetism on your personality. If you're too close to one side, as the rabbis say, the more you give into a desire, the more it attracts you, the stronger hold it has on you. The more you remove yourself from a desire, the less of a hold it has on you. So what is the goal, really, then? The goal, by being in the middle, is that you're not being pulled by either extreme of a given, I don't want to say number line, but if you could imagine a number line, 0 on the left and 100 on the right, you should be at 50. The truth is, actually, I used this example a year ago, and my friend that I study with said, no, that's not a good example to use 0 on the left and 100 on the right. You should really use 0 in the middle and plus 100 on the right, or negative 100, because that's more in line with the concept that you're giving in too much or too little. 50 would seem to imply that there's somewhat you're giving into an emotion. So really, if you want to visualize what it means to be in the middle, I mean, because every set of emotions has an extreme. That's what they say, there's not much difference between love and hate, because they're two sides of the same coin. What you really want to do is not be giving into too much of either. But the reason for that is a higher goal, and that is that you're freed from the emotions, and or that now your intelligence is not being bombarded with impulses, and now you could be as free as possible from the emotions to be involved in wisdom and study. So that when Maimonides says that you shouldn't be giving in too much to one emotion or to its opposite extreme, what he means to say is that you should be in a situation an emotional state where you're even keeled, where there's nothing pulling on you, for the goal of being primed to learn and being involved in wisdom without any pulls. Because if a person is such a high energy person, he can't sit down and study for hours. His energies won't let him do that. Okay, so that's important why you know, this concept, tangentially, but it's related to this idea. So again, on the one hand, Christianity is praising and putting on a pedestal the nuns and priests that deny the emotions, and specifically the sexual drive, whereas Judaism looks at it realistically. They are drives that God gave to man and wishes that man be involved, but in the right amount, at the right times, with the right partners. And again, this will allow man to be more even-keeled, more controlled of his emotions, so then he can pursue a life of intelligence. And just as a proof that the whole Christian mode of operation of denial of sex, or the guilt that that the sexual act is riddled with, you look at the current accounts of all these priests that are sodomizing children. This demonstrates Judaism's accurate view on the need for the sexual satisfaction and what the repercussions are of those who deny the real desires that we have. So the priests that are actually not engaging in sexual activity, you can't just stifle it. It's impossible. It's going to be expressed somehow. So what they do, they sodomize children. And these accounts are coming up all over the place now. So you see how it's against whole human nature. Judaism, on the other hand, is in line perfectly with human nature, because Judaism was designed by God, as opposed to Christianity, which was fabricated by man. So, by definition, since God designed Judaism, Judaism's laws are going to be perfectly in line with man's nature, and man will have the most serene and even-keeled and happy life by following what God lays out for him, not adding and not detracting from it. Now, there's one other contradiction which you see from this view that the Christians have about denying sexual. I mean, if you ask any nun or priest if what they're doing is good, of course. They'll devote their entire life's work to being nuns and priests. So what this basically says is that they feel this is God's will, that their existence is a good, right? They're saying, by definition of living as a nun or a priest, that their existence in this manner is a good and God desires it. But there's a very strong contradiction, and that is that their very abstinence does not allow new children to enter the world who themselves can become nuns and priests. I mean, if the nuns and priests feel that human existence is a good when one is a nun or a priest, so their very abstinence prevents other nuns and priests from being born and continuing their own work. So again, there's an internal contradiction in the lifestyle of a nun and a priest. On the one hand, they're saying it's a good thing to be a nun and a priest. It's a necessary type of a personality. On the other hand, they're not producing more nuns and priests. So it's a contradiction. Okay, so that's number two in the section here that we're talking about, the primitive nature of Christianity and also what the mass appeal is. And the truth is, since many people feel guilty about sex because they're raised in, only because they're raised in this culture. If you weren't raised in this culture, and in the American culture, which, you know, is predominantly, you know, Catholic in origin, but in terms of the views that permeate society, if we didn't have this type of upbringing, we wouldn't have any type of a guilt associated with sex. Sex would be a natural thing as eating. It's a need. You take care of it. You enjoy it. You do it in the right type of level of involvement, but still you guide your life, you know, by reason. Okay. We'll take up two more points on this section, and then we'll pause again for a few questions or comments. All right. Okay. The next concept over here is about the eating of Jesus' body. And I'll quote. This is from Matthew 26, verses 26 to 28. Okay, and I quote. Okay, this is New Testament, Matthew. Now, as they were eating, Jesus took bread and blessed it, and broke it, and gave it to the disciples, and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink of it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. End quote. So Jesus himself is saying, eat my body and drink my blood. Okay. So Christianity's practice, even today, of eating a wafer symbolizing Jesus' body, traces itself back to primitive cultural rites. In one practice, members of a cult would actually drink the blood of animals, believing it to imbue them with that animal's characteristics. So if it was a tiger, they felt they'd become strong and invulnerable, like a tiger and vicious. And that was a trait that maybe the Indians or primitive societies would believe in. And this is something which you see is being echoed and duplicated in these words. Now, it may sound very nice, eat of my body or drink of my blood, but you have to stop and ask yourself, all right, let's understand, what is this catering to? Where is it coming from? I mean, God didn't say it. Oh, it came from man. So in any man-made religion, you're undoubtedly going to discover evidence of man's base instinctual drives. Man-made religion is, in truth, a projection of man's instinctual drives that are repressed. And any system that man makes is going to reflect man's instinctual nature. So Christianity succeeds at deviating completely from God's will. Unlike Judaism, the practice of eating the body of Jesus has no correlation to anything true. So they're just reinforcing lies, they're reinforcing fallacy. And what it does further, it embellishes on the need for the attachment to the physical, and it represses a natural human desire and need. Okay. So you see that the body now becomes, I mean, Jesus again is taking the focus of the Christian religion, not God. Again, you see another example of that here by eating of his body. But you see, it also caters to a primitive falsehood. I mean, you don't become like the animal because you eat his blood. It's ridiculous. That all has to do with the psychological makeup. People feel if you put a pig's heart in somebody, so that is now going to make them like the pig. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's never happened. They've put animal hearts, and you don't see this happening. I'm not sure if they did. I'm not sure if they put animal hearts in people. I'm just saying if they transplanted one animal heart to another animal, so you don't see the one animal changing into another one. So again, we use science, we use intelligence. But here what we're really trying to do is expose that there's a very primitive concept that actually is something not new in Christianity. And lastly, we should mention also the whole concept of the resurrection, of Jesus' resurrection. And on this point, I would say like this, the belief in the immortality, which is basically what resurrection is, it means you could die and you can come back. Now, Judaism doesn't say there's no resurrection, but we go according to what God's promises, that is the view that certain individuals will come back and maybe perhaps needed for the establishment of when our true Messiah comes, whenever it's going to be. We don't calculate it because that's against Judaism to calculate when the Messiah comes. I actually heard a class today where the rabbi was discussing and saying that the reason why the rabbis of the Talmud would say that you should their expression was like a blast the bones of people that calculate the ends, meaning, or blast their souls. You should people really the deserving of death, people that start to calculate when the Mashiach is coming, because to try to start calculating when the Messiah is coming means to say that it's not due to your own free will. They're trying to say there's certain things that we have to force into our activities now in order to force the coming of the Messiah. And that's something which Jew and Gentile alike today are involved in. But that's really just a fabrication of trying to force something which should be happening through man's own perfection. So if Messiah is going to come because man reaches a certain level of perfection, so perfection comes about by people on a regular basis introspecting, detecting their flaws, understanding the corruption and the damage to themselves due to these flaws, and abandoning such behavior in order that they perfect themselves. This type of an approach is what is going to ultimately bring a time where Mashiach, where the Messiah will be on earth, where there will be a good reception for him. But just to try to force things which there's no self-reflection, that's ridiculous. That's actually counter. It counters the whole coming of the Mashiach. So we don't get involved in calculating it. We're involved in perfection. Introspection, seeing what's true, just like we're discussing now. Trying to understand what flaws exist in the world so we can remove ourselves from them. And we have the knowledge in order to benefit people that are not Jewish that really want the truth. I mean, it's our goal as Jews to educate. This is what, you know, God gave us a system that we should be the ones that are studying all the time in order to educate the rest of, of mankind, which is equally God's will. Okay. So the belief in immortality, just to sum up this section now, and then we'll stop in a second. The belief in immortality and fortune tellers are just fabricated solutions to man's basic fears. What are the fears? Number one, death. And number two, security about one's own earthly fate. So the belief in the resurrection, this being part of a whole Christian culture and religion, is giving man a false sense of security that he's going to come back to. He's going to share in the eternal kingdom. All right? And number two, it also gives man a sense of security about his own future, whereas what man should be doing is guiding his own life by reason in order that he secures the best life for himself in that method. So with the resurrection of Jesus, according to Christianity, his second coming, Christianity basically gives a false hope, not only in Jesus' immortality, but in his followers as well, because they too will share in this eternal kingdom. And resurrection also attempts to validate Christianity, as the second coming alludes to Christianity's, which is, interestingly, this whole concept of resurrection. Like, why did they bring this in as part of their whole creed? I mean, it wasn't fabricated by fools. The people who constructed and fabricated Christianity had certain goals in mind. They knew certain things about human nature and wanted to appeal. And you see, they were really on target in terms of the appeal of getting so many adherents over the years. Because you see how fast it caught on. But what I want you to think about this, and that is that what does resurrection do? This concept in Christianity that there's resurrection of Jesus. What it really does, if you think about it, it is trying to cover up an unspoken doubt about Jesus' true validity. Again, it's covering up their unspoken doubt of Jesus' validity. Why do I say that he wasn't valid? And that's why they use resurrection. Because his first coming wasn't conclusive. If he was successful in the first appearance, the first coming as they put it, there's no need for a resurrection. If everything was successful, if everything was done. The very concept of a resurrection means to say the work is not done. There was a failure. And they knew there was a failure. He was killed. They make us a story afterwards that some people saw him somewhere, and then he said he'll come back. But why they say that it was just one or two people saw him and said he's going to come back? Because he didn't. Nobody saw him. But they fabricated. There were no witnesses to that because it didn't happen. But the very fact that they say that's it, he disappeared, is not nobody sees him anymore because he's dead. That's it. Okay. So it's very important to really see through and not just, you know, take for granted why do all these elements exist in Christianity. But there are certain appeals to it, and there's also, you see that they're trying to cover their tracks. And again, I'm not speaking about individuals, I'm speaking about the fabricators. The ones that put it together, I'm trying to expose what the real flaws are. So you can understand that it's really false, it's fabricated, and it shouldn't have any emotional pull on you. Okay, so we'll sum up this section, we'll take some questions now. Okay, so the third area we're going to take up now is Christianity's denial of God's own words, and we'll use quotes here to show you what we're talking about. All right, the first one's in terms of false prophets. So the Torah teaches in Deuteronomy 18, chapter 18, verses 19 and 20, and I'll read it to you. I'll quote, and it will be the man who does not listen to my words, but who speaks in my name, I will inquire from him, and God will punish him. However, a prophet who sinfully speaks a matter in my name, which I did not command to speak, and he speaks in the name of other gods, you must kill that prophet. End quote. So, primarily the distortion here is that Jesus spoke against God's laws in God's name, attempting to change what God said. And God's Torah teaches that this crime is so great, it deserves death. As it says at the end of the quote, you must kill that prophet. So you see how grave a sin it is that a person speaks in God's name against God, or if he speaks in other God's names. And primarily both of these sins were attributable to Jesus, because they're now making a new concept of God, so it's not God anymore. And he said things completely against the system of Judaism. There was as you'll see, that there's an abolishment of divorce. Divorce is something which God said is a good. It's part of the Torah system. And Christianity abrogated it. Okay, so that's number one. So number one is that false prophets have a very severe penalty. Number two is incomparability to Judaism, which you'll see in Christianity's faith, the whole religion. So a further false proof of Christianity's claim of the supreme religion is the following. We might ask why God did not perform such an undeniably true event as Sinai on behalf of Christianity. Meaning to say, if God wishes something to have the same recognition as Sinai as truth, He has the ability. We see from Sinai that God has the ability to create an event that, it's undeniably true. But we see that this was not something which any other religion has. This is not, you don't have any event where you have a mass revelation except Judaism. So Christianity has an inherent flaw, as do all religions on this point, that they lack any type of proof. So what they're trying to do is saying they have the supreme religion. However, if it's true that this is God's will, so why doesn't God show with an undeniable proof in front of masses that His will has changed? I mean, the concept of God changing His will in itself is ridiculous. And I'll quote you now from the Torah itself, from God's own words, that He never would do this again. It says in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 19, quote, "These matters," referring to the Ten Commandments, "God spoke to your entire assembly from amidst flames, cloud, and thick darkness, a great voice not to be repeated. And He wrote them on two tables of stone and gave them to me." End quote. So what Moses is telling the Jews here, he's recalling once again the event of Sinai, but he's saying it's a great voice not to be repeated. God said He's not going to do this again. Meaning there's only one endorsement of only one lifestyle of the Torah system, and that's it. There's no such need for any change. I mean, God doesn't know the future. God has to now update His system and make changes later on. That's basically their claim. God clearly states that such a revelation at Sinai, such a selection of a people, and specifically a giving of a law of the Torah, will never be repeated. That's openly in the Torah. And again, Christians hold on to the Old Testament, which is our Chumash, our five books of Moses. Why do they hold on to it? I mean, you're going to make a new religion, why don't you just start from scratch? Well, the problem is you can't erase what is true historically, and the entire Torah is accepted as true. So they couldn't get rid of it. They knew that it wouldn't catch on. They wanted to establish a new religion. The only way to do it is to have some element of truth in there. If they would deny all history that took place, no way that would they be accepted. So again, God clearly states that the revelation and the selection of the Jews and giving of the Torah is never going to be repeated, right? A great voice not to be repeated. It's openly Deuteronomy 5:19. So they're in contradiction with themselves. So these are God's words, and Christianity denies them with their fabrication when they make a statement that God endorsed the new system of Christianity. So what this shows us is that Christianity's ideology is based on lies told to its followers, duping them into believing that God has a new plan, even though that God stated such a revelation will never be repeated. So it's basically lies. Okay. And And the final point on this section that I want to make is that Christianity violates God's command not to alter God's Torah. So where do we see there's a command not to alter God's Torah? Well, in the Torah itself. In Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 2, God says, quote, "Do not add on to the matter which I command you, and do not detract from it, to observe the commandments of Hashem your God, which I command you." So God says clearly, do not add on and do not detract from the commandments. So the Torah itself has in it, again, God knows the future, and everything is in the Torah necessary for the Torah to stay intact, and that's why it is. And that's why these tools are what we use to expose the falsehood and the contradictions that exist in all other religions. But again, specifically we're talking about the flaw of Christianity's abrogation of divorce and other laws, prohibitions or views that they hold that go against the Torah. So when they make even one change, that's it. They have violated the Torah. But they've made numerous changes. Okay, so again, so that ends the third section. Let me just give you the headings again, what we just discussed. We talked about false prophets and what the punishment is for speaking against God's word, which Jesus clearly did, and speaking in another God's name, which clearly that's what the whole Christianity is. They're not accepting the true God. They have this whole Trinity. Number two, we said, was the incomparability to Judaism, that there's really no comparison in terms of what Judaism uses to show by scientific proof that the events took place. And again, with the proof you have is that the whole event at Sinai. The fact is also inherent in that proof is the words of God where he says, a great voice not to be repeated. And God himself says there's only going to be one mass revelation. That's it. And in general, a great voice not to be repeated. So anybody who wants to say that there was another revelation, especially when they're saying that a new system is going to replace the original Torah, is completely going against God's words. Period. And I want you to know, there's no real need. I hear a lot of times in different groups and online classes where their approach to counter missionaries or Christians trying to preach that Christianity is correct, their whole approach is to dismantle the arguments of the Christian. But you don't have to go there. The best way to show what is true is you look at what was already proven, what God's words are, and you see clearly. That's where the best proof is. Let them respond. They accept the Torah. So let them to respond how they can alter it. You don't have to now, well, let them have their new words and quote their Bible. I mean, these things are false. Let them, they're accepting the Torah, work from the Torah. Use that as your approach. And you'll see that you'll have an ironclad argument, and they'll have no answer. And the third topic we discussed was how Christianity violates God's command not to alter the Torah. And that's very plain. That's very clear. Okay, so now we're going to take... okay, 1 second, we have a question. Okay, so now I'm going to take up the fourth and final area that I wanted to discuss today. The first the basic category of this fourth section is the nature of Christianity's corruption and also plagiarism that you'll see clearly when I give you examples that exist and why this takes place. Now, I'll start off with first showing how Christianity portrays Jesus, that his reasoning was really unjust. I'll give you just one example. I'm quoting from Matthew 26, verses 6 through 13. Quote, "Now when Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, a woman came up to him with an alabaster flask, a very expensive ointment, and she poured it on his head as she sat at the table. But when the disciples saw it, they were very indignant, saying, 'Why this waste? For the ointment might have been sold for a large sum and given to the poor.'" Now if you stop right there, that's a very good sentiment that the disciples said. You're taking all this oil, it's very expensive, and you're pouring it on Jesus' head. You could have sold that oil and supported a lot of poor people. But what was Jesus' response? So, quote, "But Jesus, aware of this, said to them, 'Why do you trouble the woman? For she has done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me. In pouring this ointment on my body, she has done it to prepare me for burial. Truly I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her.'" End quote. So basically, the people feel that this money could be used to help the poor. Jesus says, no, she's preparing me for death. And he says, no, the poor are not as important as I am. That's basically what Jesus said. The poor are not as important as Jesus. Those are Jesus' words. So Jesus is here on record as preferring kindness to himself over the poor. His reasoning is that he will not always be around. Therefore, one must prefer to share oil with Jesus than using the monetary value of that oil to support the needy. I mean, the reasoning is absurd. Who cares that Jesus won't always be around? The oil itself is not necessary for giving and sustaining lives of people. They're just pouring it on his head for a comfort. Whereas you can use the monetary value of the oil to sustain people who don't have any money. So this is just an example in terms of the reasoning of Jesus to be unjust. This is not morally correct. All right? But again, people are very much swayed and drawn in by the way it's verbalized. And why do you trouble the woman? For she has done a beautiful thing to me. And then he goes on, truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is preached. Well, what gospel? And he's now all of a sudden saying that his words are now gospel. I mean, that's a pretty haughty thing. The greatest man ever to live, Moses, did not say his words were gospel. All right, and the Torah itself even talks about Moses' own sin, because we don't idolize man. This goes back to the previous point we made, that man is not to take the focus. God is the only focus we have. We don't have any type of deification of man, of making a man into a hero. This is false. That's where the Torah exposes the flaws, is to teach us that even the most righteous individuals cannot escape sin. Okay, so that's number one. That Christianity itself, again, it shoots itself in the foot by showing a corrupt thinking of their leader. The leader himself does not have compassion on the poor. Now, what type of leader is that? Okay. Let's move on to the second point I want to make in this section regarding the corrupt philosophy is now moving on to plagiarism. Okay, where do you see plagiarism? A number of cases, but I'll give you some very glaring ones. Let's compare the Torah's words, Christianity's plagiarism. The Torah says in Exodus 4:19, and I quote, right, so this is regarding Moses. God's quote, God said to Moses in Midian, go, return to Egypt, for there have died all the men that sought your life. So before Moses' mission to go down to Paro and to try to emancipate the people, to free the Jews, God says to Moses in Midian, go, return to Egypt, for there have died all the men that sought your life. Okay? And in Matthew, the following states. This is 2:20. Rise, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead. All right? A clear plagiarism of where it says, for all the men that sought your life are dead. That was stated in connection with Moses. So, what does Christianity do? What do the fabricators of Christianity do? They try to transpose onto Jesus certain sentiments that were expressed and were familiar concerning Moses. So it's a very good ploy. But when you see how closely they mimicked it, you can see clearly through the charade. Let me give you another example. The Torah says in Exodus, the first chapter 1, verse 16, quote, and the king of Egypt said, when the Hebrew women give birth and look upon the stone, if it is a son, kill him, and if it is a daughter, let it live. So we're all familiar with how Paro wanted to wipe out the males when his people told him that the Savior was born. So, again, this has to do, it's the response of the astrologer to Paro, that you have to kill the males because a male has been born, and we don't know whether it's from the Egyptians or whether it's from the Jews. So what does Paro say? I'll say it again. Quote, again, Exodus 1:16. And the king of Egypt said, and he was saying this to the midwives,
when the Hebrew women give birth, look upon the stone. Evidently, they gave birth on a birthstone. If it is a son, kill him, and if it is a daughter, let it live. Now let's compare this to what the New Testament, the Christian's Bible, says in Matthew 2:16. Quote, "Then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, was in a furious rage, and he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under." Again, a clear plagiarism of Judaism. And in both cases, it was the king, it was the leader. In one case, it was Paro. In the New Testament, it was Herod. In the first case by Moses, it was due to the fact that the Savior was born. The same exact case was by Herod. And what did he do? He killed all the male children. Paro killed all the males. And Herod said the same thing. So again, you see a plagiarism. All right. In both instances, Christianity attempts to equate Jesus to Moses by fabricating similar victimizations. Just as Moses was threatened by the ruler, by Paro, so the story constructed about Jesus makes him the victim of the ruler Herod. So you see, in both cases, they're trying to do is to portray Jesus as a victim. Also, it was done precisely at the time of birth, to mimic the threat which actually occurred at the birth of Moses. So just like at the time when Jesus was born, so soon after, you have this whole thing about killing the firstborn. Now, not the first, excuse me, not killing the first one, killing the males. So why are they copying this? Again, you have to ask yourself a question. Why was this the area that they wanted to mimic? So my feeling is the reason why is because they wanted to develop an attachment to Christianity. They wanted to get a lot of followers. How do you get followers? Well, you have to get them to identify with the leader. And what's a very good tool for identification? Empathy. But not just empathy on anybody, especially if it's empathy or sympathy on a child. So you see what they did? Very, very cunningly, they constructed a story, but they looked at something which had that appeal in the Torah already. So this way it would echo a certain feeling of a biblical sentiment. It would give it some validity because people would say, oh yeah, that sounds like a real biblical story. But you see, they just copied it pretty much word for word. So what happened was that at precisely Jesus' birth, so they wanted to mimic the threat which actually occurred at the birth of Moses. An account where a child, Jesus, where his life is threatened at that point, again, it might have been selected for duplication, as killing a child will engender a certain feeling of pity on the reader. By duplicating the true events surrounding Moses' birth, Christianity hopes to raise Jesus to Moses' status as a leader. So again, the goal is to try to raise Jesus up to a leader status. Okay. And the same thing with the case where they said that the return to land of Israel, which is stated in the New Testament, because all those who sought the child's life are dead. So that was basically copied, almost word for word, what happened when God said to Moses, go back to Egypt, because all those men that sought your life are dead. All right? So it's very clear. So just taking the actual stories of Moses and transposing it and just changing the name and then transposing it onto Jesus. And I would say like this, just as a further point on this, that perhaps for the very reason of engendering pity as a tool for identification with Jesus, meaning they want to engender this feeling of pity in order to create an identification with Jesus. So what do? Christianity adopts the symbol of the cross. Why? Why is the cross such a central icon? Because it displays see, the cross is unanimous acceptance itself, I mean by the Christians, as a central icon of the religion, displays how correct the developers of Christianity were, that pity is a surefire lure to attract more adherents. So by using this pity, this type of a symbol, oh, look at the poor man on the cross, he's dead, that evokes pity, it creates an identification, and it's a way to lure more people because you're trying to hit them, you're trying to get them by some very base emotions. Now let me give you one more example in terms of plagiarism, which is, I think, one of the most transparent. It says in Genesis, in the Torah, in our Torah, the accurate law, chapter 37, it's verse 25. And I quote, this is by the sale of Joseph. And there passed, and I'm quoting here, and there passed by Midianite men, traitors, and they drew him and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph to Egypt. Okay, so that's the quote in the Torah. What does it say in Matthew 26:14? And I quote, the one, then, one of the 12, the disciples, who was called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, what will you give me if I deliver him to you? And they paid him 30 pieces of silver. Now look at this here. I mean, it's clear. What are the elements you have? You have by Joseph, he had 12 brothers. You have by Jesus, there were 12 disciples. You have by Joseph, he was sold. You have by Jesus, he was sold. Joseph was sold for 20 pieces of silver. Jesus was sold for 30 pieces of silver. So you see a clear plagiarism, an event that never took place, but what they're trying to do again, it's, again, Christianity is selecting another case of victimization. You see in both cases, it's talking about where Jesus was victimized for the purpose of evoking empathy and identification with this quote-unquote victimized Jesus, who wasn't victimized in this way. These are fabricated stories. So the person used as a model for Jesus is Joseph, a ruler. Again, there was another element. Look what they did. They looked for a story that had some sort of a leader, because Joseph eventually came leader of Egypt. So what did they try to do in order to bolster the image of Jesus? They would use a story that also talked about a leader. So they try to equate Jesus with the Joseph. So Christianity is clearly transparent in its attempt to borrow stories from rulers in the Torah for its own agenda of raising Jesus to a leadership role. Plagiarizing the Torah's leaders' personalities is for the goal, primarily, of breeding a familiarity in this new character of Jesus, with the goal of gaining wider acceptance for Christianity through acceptance of Jesus as a leader. So we talked about the fact that Christianity does plagiarize in numerous cases, and in some cases it's amazing how identical the stories are, from elements of 12 brothers to 12 disciples, to being sold to Egypt, to being sold to the priests for 20 pieces of silver as opposed to 30 pieces of silver. I mean, they probably just changed it to 30 because they didn't want it to be that close, so they had to make some deviation. But the truth is, that doesn't help. You see how close it is. And you see that the stories themselves, the fabricators of Christianity, knew would not wouldn't be followed if it didn't have a certain sense of a biblical tone. So, but they did more. They gave themselves away, because it's not just that they take the tone of the Bible, but they copied stories. But again, keep in mind, what they did was clever. They looked for stories of leaders, because Moses was a leader that they copied, and Joseph was a leader. And they looked for cases where they were victimized. Right? Moses being subject to the threat of Pharaoh, that the male should be killed, and Jesus too. And Joseph being sold, and Jesus being sold. So they're looking to create a story where Jesus is victimized, where he's equated to a person who had a leadership role, and they use identical elements of the stories that were actually true in connection with Moses and Joseph, and they transpose those elements onto a new, slightly different story by Jesus, all for the goal of trying to gain acceptance. But all in a sense where it's a victimized role, it's a victimized person. Okay. So in summary, and we'll take some questions after we wrap it up, but let's just sum up. So Christianity basically lies to its people. It contradicts God's own words, and it's a religion where reason is second to belief, meaning belief is more important than reason. And also we use deceit as a means of attracting, you know, people to become proselytes. Now, it's important that you don't feel compelled to adhere to Christianity. I mean, another point, because there is a lot of popularity, there are many leaders, and they get dressed up in beautiful garments, and they have impressive structures and churches, and there's so many ancient paintings dating back to so many centuries ago
depicting Jesus and the church's long history and the sense of piety that's associated with nuns and priests. But you can't let these things catch you. These are all just trappings. And again, the Torah does not miss a point. The Torah addresses this. What should a person do when he sees all this? We're not oppressed, because the truth is, previous idolaters also had great structures, and they wore very ornate clothing, and their practices were widespread. Yet, I mean, in terms of what we follow, we still admit that their ideas are false. Even though they had the same type of spread and widespread acceptance and popularity and beautiful clothing and such a long history. History does not mean that it's true. History just means a lot of people were following something. A historical event witnessed by millions, that we know is true. So you have to keep that clear in your mind. Just because people ask you, well, just because you have Judaism written down in books and accepted for thousands of years, so, you know, Christianity has the same thing. Yeah, but Christianity does not have the basic elements of proof. And that is that events, miraculous events, were not witnessed by masses. That you only have once to the Jews at Sinai, and God's own words, we said, he promises he'll never do it again. So Christianity goes against God's words on so many occasions, as we brought out. And reason teaches us that what is false cannot become true just because they adorn it. So we don't care about the beautiful garments and all this. And I'll quote from King Solomon in Proverbs. He says like this, quote, "A gold ring in the snout of a pig, so too is a beautiful woman with a deviant personality." So what is King Solomon telling us? He's telling you, basically, that it doesn't matter how beautiful the ring is, if it's in the snout of a pig, it's not going to make any type of it's not going to beautify the pig at all. Meaning, if the essence, the pig is the essence of the thing, and the ring is just an accidental ornament. So you can take Christianity and all the false ideas and dress it up and give it all this beautiful culture, and that's probably why they did all this. They wanted to attract the emotions and all the incense and the beautiful choirs and the hymns and all these things that just appeal to the emotions. But that does not make something false into a truth. Reason alone is what we use to determine whether something is true. And even in our own Torah, I'll quote you something from Radak. Radak is a very ingenious commentator on the Torah. And in the in Sefer Sefanya, chapter 1, verse 8, so Radak, who comments there, because it talks over there how God says that God had punished the Jews that wore strange clothing. So what does it mean? God punished Jews that wore strange clothing. Means to say, the Radak says, he teaches that God punished certain Jews who dressed in clothing more impressive than their brother Jews, only to project a false piety. But you see, no, God doesn't approve of that. God punished them. God does not approve of people when they try to externalize a certain piety. That really shows how imperfect they really are. So God actually punished these Jews. And again, the Torah doesn't cover up if Jews do something wrong. That's part of the truth of the Torah. We discuss openly what is false, and we want people to follow what is only true. So external dress is frowned upon by God, clearly, and has no bearing on one's perfection and destroys social harmony. So the whole concept in Christianity with this is all this ornate clothing and hats and all this. Again, maybe they feel justified, and they have a question on Judaism. Why does the high priest wear? See, that's not in order to make the high priest into the central focus over God. Each one of the garments that the high priest wore was commanded by God. That's not the case by Christianity. That they made up themselves in order to adorn themselves. So they missed the point on that. If God tells you to dress a certain way for only a few individuals, the priests, but nobody else, so clearly that is not the right way to live in general. Why did the priests wear it? Well, then you have to study each one of the garments. The breastplate had the 12 tribes on it. That's, and where was it worn? Against his heart. So my understanding on that is that it wants to show that the high priest is supposed to embody the most perfected human being. And what does the most perfected human being do? He has all of his brethren close to his heart. So that's why the 12 tribes next to his heart. But he also had a gold plate on his forehead that had God's name on it. Why? Because in terms of the heart, man's emotions, that goes out to man. So you have the 12 tribes are on the breastplate in order to show that next to the breast, next to the heart, that the high priest's heart is attached to his 12 tribes, all the brethren, all the Jews. And keep in mind also that in the Jewish temple, we accepted the sacrifices of the non-Jew. That is something which we accepted because we want everybody to approach God. So it wasn't a closed society. It wasn't something which was off limits to a non-Jew. You have to keep clear that God desires Gentile and Jew alike. Right? Set the question why there's a different set of commands for each. That does not mean there's a preference in terms of the existence of the Jew over the Gentile. And we said again earlier that God wants the Jew to learn and have all his commands in order to teach the Gentile. So our concern is that everybody follows the Torah. Everybody has the right concept of God. Now again, the breastplate was next to the heart because the heart represents the emotions, the seat of the emotions. And we want to demonstrate that the perfected person who the high priest is representing, his heart is attached to all of his brothers. But what was on his head, and the head is the seat of the intellect, figuratively, the head had the gold plate that said God's name on it, holy to God. Meaning to say, the intellect of man, that's subject to God's will. So you see the clothing of the high priest had very profound ideas. Okay. Okay, so in summary, I would tell you this. So God's Torah requires one to use one's mind and to seek proof for one's actions. Again, in contrast to Christianity, where blind faith and reason is not the tool. So the Torah itself, it contains those proofs, so many may be able to function in accordance with intelligence, leading a life which is pleasing and reasonable. What happens afterwards, after man stops studying the Torah, he becomes very impressed with the sensibility of all the tenets of Judaism, and he's encouraged to derive all the benefit, not only in actions that are good for himself and society, but he engages his mind, he discovers insights which offer him the most satisfying life. Intelligence is the one faculty that God gave man and nobody else. We've said this many times. So God's desire is that mankind enjoys life and only use his intelligence to study reality and perceive wisdom which affords a person the greatest obtainable existence. Intelligent inquiry is the sole tool enabling our appreciation of all sciences and of Judaism. God created sciences and Judaism to reflect his wisdom, both equally. Through our minds, we see the beauty in this Torah system, and we find the solid proofs and reasons for God's laws and his ideals. And what ends up is that we become enamored with the depths of the structures of the Torah laws, and not just the ideas of the philosophy of the Torah, but then we start seeing the beautiful structure of how the laws are set up. When and where we do this, when and where we don't do this, and what the ideas are, and when two laws come in to play, which one goes first. I mean, there's so many ideas, just in terms of how the whole law is structured, that this gives us a tremendous satisfaction. God's perfect Torah system applies to both Gentile and Jew. There's no other God-given system, and there never will be. So therefore, there is no other good for all of mankind. Okay, this is God's will. It happened once, the Torah was given, and God's word is never to be duplicated.